Welcome to Polycast, the civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Vian Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-hosts.
Just saying.
Ruben.
Zarish.
When you get to the later point in the game, and there are all these different units on the map, and you're trying to move the units on the map, but you can't move the units on the map because there's units on the map.
Yeah.
Welcome to episode 266. I'm the Man Team, joined by regular co-host Dan Q.
Is it time for pumpkin spice again?
Makalua?
I think that's why we put Phil in the box, because he was trying to give us pumpkin spice things.
Hey, it's the season. And I'm also joined by guest co-host Hussein.
Holy God, Gilgamesh has big muscles.
DC Zarash.
I want to be the last Viking king.
And Ruben.
Am I the only one whose head is about to explode with information overload?
Your head explode. No way. Let it go in one ear, out the other, and you're good. It's like a filter or a pass-through. So, just reduce your strength. You should be fine.
There it is.
We really are.
There it is. Whoop, there it is. You see, kids. let's get it started in here. Yeah, you better hurry up and start talking, or it's going to become Polycast the Musical, and Mackie will leave in rage.
All right,
so... Are we doing the sing-off? Is this the sing-off episode?
Yes, when you have the crappy quality, relatively speaking, yes, and we will hold that against you completely. What?
Well, to give you guys a chance, right?
Oh, that's some smack talk. Wait, no, we're not talking about Alpha Centauri. Civilization 6. Go, go, go.
Rogue First Look video, which had us looking at Trajan, I believe he's the first non-Caesar to be playing Rome, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, he seems like quite a strong early game expander and warmonger. I'm a big fan of most of what's built in with Rome, although I bonus the Trajan's Column.
Seeing as how you get this free building from the start of a game, how many buildings are you going to have to choose from anyway?
That's true, yeah.
You usually end up with a monument, although it was mentioned in the live stream by Ed Beast that we're going to be talking about, lead designer on Civilization VI, that if you start in a later era, and I have to ask you, why would you do this to yourself? Anyway.
Well, classical's not, you know, ancient, so.
If you do that, you would already get the monument for free, regardless of what civilization you were, so then Rome would get another building on top of that. But otherwise, it is a monument. So I guess if you don't immediately find a culture city-state, it's not so bad, or it's just gravy. But otherwise, what about their special ability?
It's awesome.
Yeah, that'll be an even bigger deal once you've got, like, a big empire and you can do that little Silk Road where you just go from trading post to trading post and get +1, +1 gold, +1 gold.
Yeah, like, it's incredible for being able to just Rex because you can just get an internal trade route every time you want to make a new building. That gives me the opportunity to make new units in order to make a new expansion, which lets you just yada, yada, yada. It is incredible to just get free gold in internal trade routes. I think that's the reason they didn't let you do it in Beyond Earth or in Civilization 5. Getting the extra gold just lets you fund an army and fund the maintenance to just continue to move, which is really good. I think I like it a lot better than what they did in Civ 5.
Yeah, that is not a late-game-only ability. I would say that that's benefiting the early game more so than the late game because it's a larger proportion of your total income. The trade bonuses are there immediately. Both of those things are things that take numbers of turns for other civilizations. So not only are you more mobile from having that, you have more money right away. Early game ability to afford doing all this stuff is way up compared to other civs with that ability.
And with new cities within trade route range of the capital, they start with a road to it. Which, as we know, you can't get out your builder now and say, hey, let's construct a road right away. Oh, no, wait, those are only made until you get to a certain point in the technology tree, some kind of engineer, where you can actually decide to build your own roads. It will build the road for you. You don't have to wait for a trade route to complete between your cities. If it's within range, it starts. Okay, you do have to wait, but you don't have to decide, oh, you know, I'd really like to trade with this city-state or this other civ or whatever in order to get the road. The road will start to be built for you right away.
Exactly. It saves a lot of time off of your game and just gives you a lot of maintenance money to just deal with it. It's great.
I hope they don't end up being too strong and then they have to make the Legion weaker or something, because I always like when the special unit's fairly strong. So they're going to have to do good balancing around that, because it's looking pretty strong. That, and then the Bat District on top of all that, giving you the amenities, allowing you to grow massive.
I have a feeling that at one point in the discussion when they were making Legions, they were going to say, hey, let's let them build roads again. And then they said that's a little overpowered, so that's why you don't have Legions making roads in this game, at least so far.
I think my understanding is that they function as a military engineer to build roads as well as the Roman fort, which gives +4 defensive strength and a fortification bonus to the occupying unit, which we saw in the live stream that we'll be talking about. But it has a limited number of build charges. So maybe it's not, hey, I can build roads at infinitum, just like we'd be able to build forts at infinitum. We haven't seen that. It's more expensive than the swordsman, but it doesn't require iron. As we've talked about before, that a lot of the unique units do not require a strategic resource if, say, in Civilization V, they require a strategic resource. So I can take these legions between my cities, which are already establishing roads between them, if they were within range, although I also assume that means we can't have the roads over water, you know, yet. Maybe we have to wait for the modern era for that. Lulz. But I can have my legions going across, and maybe if I decide, man, this road isn't finishing fast enough, I can just finish it. Or I can move my legions closer to the front, and I don't have to worry about iron to get to the front for defensive purposes or offensive purposes. And I've got this monument in all of my cities that I'm building, and I'm, like, plowing through the civics tree, relatively speaking. Wow. That is a lot going on. It's so general, too. It's not very map-specific, unless you find yourself, you know, on, like, a really tiny island or something like that. And then, oh, well.
That would be a problem.
Yeah, that would be important.
Our roads lead to nowhere. We still have the aqueducts to talk about.
And I think part of the reason why that we're not talking about it as much, or the Civ community is not talking about it as much, is, number one, the special ability and the leader bonus and the unique unit go together in some respects, but also this unique infrastructure, this bath, ties into things that we really have no previous experience with in Civ.
That's a good point.
So it's hard to compare it other than, oh yeah, by the way, you're here, and maybe when Civ 6 is released, we'll be like, oh my gosh, the baths are so amazing, why did we ever talk about this other stuff?
Yeah, it's like, hey, they get more housing and amenities. What is that, again?
And it's interesting you mentioned that, because I knew someone was going to mention it, obviously, but in the live stream video about city growth and combat, which is actually more about city growth than combat, we'll be talking about amenities and housing.
I think they did a good job with Rome, just making them, that kind of nation is going to grow, it's going to grow large, it's going to grow wealthy, and it's going to be very powerful and kind of expand. So they've done a good job of kind of aligning them in a way that they have a clear identity, you know?
I like those comments that are complaining that the Roman replacement being Baths is stupid because Romans built the aqueducts, which is a dumb idea, which is not really accurate because we had aqueducts before the Romans, but...
Yeah, they're just known for them, I guess. Right?
Yeah, they're famous for them. That's why they have a unique aqueduct, people.
We have a better aqueduct. Come on.
Yeah, that's right, and that's what people remember. It's all about the marketing. They had really good press. The Romans really knew how to promote themselves.
Hey, visit our baths.
Does anybody know what his agenda is exactly? I know it's Optimus Princeps, but what is it?
Of the three first-look civilizations we're talking about for Civ 6, we know the agenda for Rome, but not the other two. It's kind of the exception to the rule that we know what the agenda is. Does not surprise me in the least. Try to include as much territory as possible in his empire. Does not like civilizations who control little territory.
Well, that makes sense. I was actually watching somebody streaming off the press copy who had Rome next to them, who bitched them out for, oh, it's nice that you're letting your enemies take all your nice lands.
Okay. And you see, that could have been, if we didn't have this official information, that could have been their hidden agenda for that game.
It does seem to line up, though.
Yeah.
But yeah, it could be. That's true.
If I'm not playing as Rome, I look forward to taking over the Roman Empire and their well-developed infrastructure. I don't know about you.
Yeah.
Thanks for developing on that for me, guys.
If you want to handle like an AI Rome early, you want to suppress them before they're getting those trade-off bonuses, before they're setting up, because dealing with a large number of cities and legions combined would be very problematic. So you'd want to shut them down in the settler phase, the way I'm picturing their bonuses stacking up. Because if you interfere with their ability to settle, their ability to get their free buildings, set up those trade posts, get those trade routes going, they're just another Civ, and the Civ with no bonuses is that, until they get the ironworking then. So I would go hard on them very fast. If you're going to attack them at all, like, do it very early or after the Legion era.
I imagine in the hands of the right player, they could be really difficult to deal with. I mean, think about this. You got Rome. He built a bunch of forts around Rome because he knows all his roads lead to Rome. Defends from there.
Otherwise, you're going to want to pacify Rome and make some other target look more enticing than you. If you're not going to go after them, or it's like, oh man, they're all the way over there, I'm not going to be able to rush them early, but eventually our borders are probably going to meet up, then be buddy-buddy with them. Don't give them any reason to go after you, and if you can, maybe give them a reason to go after somebody else. But at the very least, put yourself in good stead, especially if they're pressing on your borders and you feel like you're not in a position that you're going to be able to take them out. Play the diplomacy game absolutely with them. I mean, you could say that about any civ, but given everything that we've talked about here, it seems like on balance, at the start of the game, any civ can decide, well, there's one exception, we'll talk about lulls, but any civilization can go for any type of victory.
Someone can't do religion.
But in the case of Rome, it just kind of seems like, give me a reason not to go after you.
Give me a reason not to squish you now before you become a major pain in my ass later.
In a vacuum, it seems like a Rome that has four or five cities is going to be in a much better position than another civ with four or five cities, medieval era-ish.
Yep.
Speaking of ancient civs, lol.
Oh, nice. We are going to have Gilgamesh of Sumeria, a.k.a. Epic Man Muscles. And his unique ability is Epic Quest. Clearing a barbarian camp also grants a tribal village reward. So basically someone said, hey, do you like Lucky Huts? Well, I like Lucky Huts too. Maybe we should also turn barbarian encampments also into Lucky Huts. And that's what they did. Basically, if you play as Sumeria, you're going to want to have a little space off to the corner where there's Fog of War so that you can farm bars for the entire game.
Here's the new way to farm barbarians.
Did you want to train your army while getting Lucky Huts? There you go.
There you go.
Yeah, okay. This is something you want to do a lot in the earlier part of the game. I don't know that later on the rewards would be sufficient for the time. You could be doing other things with those units, though.
Well, in the ancient...
ancient and classical, definitely.
In ancient, it'll be really easy because... Segue.
Yes.
We have the unique unit, which is the war cart, which is a chariot ? That you can open at start, so you can just span those out instead of warriors or whatever, and they'll be faster, and they also have no penalties against spearmen or other spearmen-type units, and you also have an extra movement in the open terrain, of course.
You can also get the quote-unquote standard tribal villages, although, man, if you're playing as Sumeria, you might be like, oh, man, all I got is a tribal village reward from this? Where's my barb camp? But you can take all of the things.
Don't seem to mention exactly what that reward is.
Basically, anything you would get from a Lucky Hut.
Yeah.
What would that be?
Well, that's going to be gold or culture or Eureka bonus or an inspiration, et cetera, or a population, anything you would expect to get from a Civ 5 Lucky Hut.
I'm a little bit torn with Gilgamesh. I mean, he does seem like a more interesting version of Babylon just because he has the war cart instead of the archers, but they're going in on science again. I was kind of glad they didn't have any people with science bonuses just because of how strong he was in Civ 5, but maybe in Civ 6 it's okay since culture seems to be like the other side of the coin, you know, to science. So we'll have to see.
The next first look Civ we're talking about, we're going to be talking about some science.
Yeah. Well, I guess speaking of science, the other thing that Gilgamesh has the ziggurat, which is unique improvement for Sumeria. It provides science and culture. It doesn't say how much. I assume it's a little extra science and also adds culture, which normally wouldn't because I think it's supposed to be a library replacement, but it doesn't say here, but I assume it is. It gives you the bonuses when you're adjacent to a river, which you would normally do anyway. It cannot be built on a hill. Okay. So yeah, it gets your yields up fast, which I guess is really nice if you're building up war carts, being able to quick get a ziggurat to get on the science and culture side of thing as well.
You know, that's not going to be the Civ community's pronunciation of that, right? It's going to be ziggurat.
Oh, well, I'm going to say ziggurat, and they can't stop me. Yeah,
the ability, Epic Quest, isn't that counterintuitive in that you want to prevent barbarians?
Well, you want to prevent them from not being alive. You want to kill them and then take their rewards, and then you let them make more encampments.
Yeah, Drew, like you were saying earlier, you find a part of the map and you cordon it off where it's not going to be affecting your empire.
But
kind of stationed outside, and it's like, okay, come on, spawn in the Fog of War, and then go back in and take out the barb camp, get your gold or whatever, get the tribal village reward, back off, let it go to the Fog of War again, rinse, repeat.
Yep.
But I mean, you want to prevent barbs from spawning, so you'll have less Fog of War.
Yeah.
But in this case, you don't want recon units outside your borders in order for the camps to spawn.
That's a good point. You don't need the units, you just need the camp. So, yeah.
Yes.
But if you just see the camp, you can just kill them before they spawn more units.
And if you see a recon unit coming out of this spot of the map where you've otherwise got the Fog of War, you might be like, I think there's a camp there now. I should go in and deal with that. And then you take out the unit in the camp, and then you kill the barbarian in the camp, plus get the camp bonus, plus the tribal village reward. And I'm pretty sure if you do that, then that recon unit is not going to be a problem for you.
Yep. I hope that you can get, like, unique bonuses from the tribal huts from, like, modern era techs. And they're like, oh, whoops, we didn't mean to do that.
Oh, you mean like early on in Civ 5 where you might have that ancient ruin off somewhere and someone finds it and they say, hey, just upgraded to a rifleman.
Yep.
So, yeah, look out. I mean, it's only one unit, but still. And actually, a Eureka bonus would be even better than that because that would have far greater implications. So, 2K and Fractus, you will disregard this comment. We never said it, so if it's in there, it's fine. Don't worry about it.
Oh, shucks. I should have never revealed my plan.
No, now you've gone and done it.
Speaking of plans... The other thing that Gilgamesh has is this little weird system. They were kind of unclear in the video, but you get some bonuses helping another civ fight another civ, where I think the way that a human is going to play it is, okay, buddy, UAI buddy, you can kill all the units and I'll take the city, and then we'll be cool, right?
Yeah, Sumerian units share pillage rewards and combat experience with the nearest allied unit within 5 tiles. So, yeah, I would like to see this in action because that's a lot of moving parts. It sounds good.
5 tiles, that's a huge range.
That's a lot, yeah. Is it going to be split, though, or reduced is what I'm wondering, or is it just going to be, oh, everybody gets it?
When I saw the number, like, the number 4 popped up as, you know, the experience boost, and I think that's probably the normal. So I think it's just taking the normal value and then adding it to the other civ as well. That was my impression.
It is unclear. I'm excited that I don't understand it, which is kind of weird because most of the things we don't understand, we fear. But everything else sounds so good. How could this not be good, too? Whatever it is, it sounds great, and I want it.
Well, I'm glad that they're really taking a different approach with this game and they're not afraid to be more complex and not afraid to, you know, make these kinds of decisions.
Yeah.
You know, in the animation, if Gilgamesh takes a city or something, he should just contact you and, like, kiss his guns, you know. That's what I'm imagining I'm doing when I'm playing Sumeria.
Well, Gilgamesh contacts you, just flexes.
Excuse me, I have muscles. Would you like to use my pecs against your enemy? Well, yes, I would like that. Thank you, Sumeria.
The last book Civ today will be Saladin's Arabia. Again, there's some counterintuitive stuff here. The special ability is the Last Prophet that automatically grants Arabia a religion when the second-to-last prophet is expanded.
If he doesn't have a religion yet. Yeah.
So, if you play Arabia, you're automatically guaranteed a religion. So, that plays to a faith game.
It does seem like a bit of a crapshoot in a way, though, doesn't it?
Why?
Because aren't all the good beliefs going to be taken by then?
See, yeah, so if you decide, I'm not going to wait for that, then your special ability is null. But if you wait for that, then you might end up with a religion that's good for score, etc. But what if all the good things are taken? Air quotes, good things.
I mean,
that doesn't make sense, does it?
I guess, but there's a lot of things going for it. Like, people should remember how frustrating it was when you'd have Byzantium, who had a unique ability, especially for religion, and then you don't get a religion, and then it's just gone. In this case, like, yeah, okay, it does make sense if you don't get your belief right, but it really sucks if you're actually building for religion at all, or not even building much for religion, and just get the religion anyway. You know, you can get your growth going up, or you can get your science going up, and you don't have to worry about it. You'll get the religion. I would love to have had Byzantium have that.
There's another hidden benefit to this kind of bonus. You can completely ignore early faith investment and put your resources into expanding worker tasks kind of thing and grow without worrying about getting it at all. And that's a pretty big advantage unto itself. If you try to go for a religion in Civ 5, even if you get one, you have to invest, unless you're just lucking into multiple city states or, you know, you have a natural wonder nearby, something like that. But unless you have something like that, you need to throw hammers on faith early. And that's at the expense of military units, workers, additional cities, or more useful buildings otherwise.
Exactly.
The ability to still have your religion guaranteed is pretty strong. So how strong this ability is going to depend on if there's typically any quality benefits left on the last religion or not. If they add a couple extras, or if things are more consistently useful for later founded religions, then yeah, this could be a very strong ability. And it's going to be pretty decent regardless, because you can, at minimum, just ignore early faith investment and get off to a strong start anyway.
Exactly. Like, I very rarely build religion in Civ 5 because I'd much rather have a granary, or I'd rather have a military unit because I don't want to build the shrine for it. And just having the religion locked for me means that I can go back to it later. I think that's a very, very good opportunity cost investment.
But the last religion founded, it seems to me it'll be a kind of leftover religion with all the good stuff already taken.
Well, if you
focus on a religious game, you want the good stuff. And Arabia gets what's ever left over.
There is a list available right now of all the different beliefs at all of the different stages. But I will say that in quote-unquote Arabia's defense, it is definitely better than Byzantium. Drew, you brought that up. Because it does guarantee that Arabia is not going to be screwed out of their ability. And also, with the leader bonus, where the worship building for Arabia's chosen religion costs less. If there wasn't for the last prophet, then, well, you didn't found a religion then. So you have no worship building. And this building's going to cost less, and it's going to produce bonus science, faith, and culture. So it does ensure that you are not completely locked out of religion. And also, in fairness to this, I am thinking it being more of an issue perhaps in multiplayer as opposed to single player. And this is presuming that, of course, that anyone's going to be really paying much attention to religion in multiplayer, because I'm pretty sure the human player can be making better choices in terms of what they adopt in the AI. I guess, you know, like if the AI is doing like the Goddess of Protection thing that we have in Civ 5 with all of their foundings, then by the time I get to the Great Prophet, if I'm Arabia and it's going to be the last religion, maybe all the good things are still left.
I think it's similar to the emission of strategic resources required for unique units, that if you have, in this case, a religion-oriented civ, you're guaranteed a religion. I like that. I just find it counterintuitive that if I want to play a religious game in Civ 5, I would get my religion out as soon as possible and not wait until the second-to-last one is founded.
Yeah, exactly. That's how I feel too. I think it doesn't really make sense. I mean, I'm glad they have it, and it's nice they don't get screwed up, but maybe they should have something else on there.
Well,
you know, like, oh, you get a missionary as well, or something like that.
Or some kind of special religious trait that only Arabia gets.
Yeah.
Well, I think that there's a lot of, not just pantheons, but like beliefs that will help your faith, even if it's not particularly optimal, which goes into the unique building, which gives you more faith. And I think that even if you don't have a great religion, it'll give you a lot of faith for generating or buying or whatever great people. So that's good enough for me, honestly.
Arabia is really focused on accumulating a lot of faith. They get discounts on buildings built with faith. Plus, those buildings provide extra science, faith, and culture.
And speaking of, their unique infrastructure is...
That's the madrasa.
Yes.
I think it replaces the university. And, of course, it also accumulates faith. It seemed like a pretty straightforward bonus. There's nothing special about it. Boost, 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 boost.
And this is also one of those pieces that you want to go through the civic tree in order to unlock, as opposed to the tech tree, because it unlocks a theology, which is a civic in Civ 6.
Mm-hmm. Well, the last thing to say about Arabia is their unique unit, the Mamluk Knight Replacement. Well, they heal at end turn, even if they attack.
Or move.
I find it quite uninspired. Actually, I'm not a big fan
of
Arabia, but maybe that's just the way I play the Civ games.
They're really good anti-personnel units that can just kill everything up to a city while all your other units are walking along to get there. And... I think that's what the Mamluks will be helpful. The idea of them being called the Mamluks, I think everyone who has played EU4 has cringed because of it, but I think it's funnier that way.
So it's kind of a blitz unit in that you have a fast movement and you heal automatically.
Yeah.
Oh, and of course, we just like with Samaria, we don't know what their agenda item is, but maybe not as a main agenda, but a hidden agenda item, Arabia would be hilarious, which would be, you founded your religion before me. Oh, I don't like you, lulz. Troll.
So very similar to Sibella then. You have a religion that's not mine, I hate you.
Pretty much, yeah.
There was the latest Firaxis Games live stream for Civilization VI, Civ VI's developer, both Ed Beachley, designer, and Anton Stranger. Back again, they showed off two different games, one as Rome, where Ed led. It was about 40 minutes of the hour, and then for about 12, 15 minutes, somewhere in there, the Congo game, led by Anton. And Congo showed modern era combat.
Yeah.
And I love the new branding for these live streams, which is show off. Civ developers, show off. Civ developers, show off. And it's like, can you just release the game? But anyway, they're showing off combat and city growth in the live stream. And one of the last things we saw was the world ranking screen. And they went into the overall tab. They're showing science, culture, domination, and religion. And in religion, when you mouse over a particular civilization, it's going to tell you not only the faith per turn, but also the converted cities. Not what the cities are, but the number of cities.
Yep.
So there is also culture, which will show you tourism per turn and culture per turn. We also saw some modifiers such as tourism, you get a plus 25% boost with the trade route, or you get a minus 15% hit for different governments, and that's like between your civ and another civilization. And on the culture screen, it will also show you the current output as well as the lifetime output of your tourism. Ooh. Not your lifetime output of your culture, but the lifetime output of your tourism, which is interesting, and I'm thinking, why are you showing that to me? Is that just for bragging rights, or is there some kind of connection to the game? Is there some sort of significance? I don't know. They never hovered over the domination screen, because grr, but I did like the science. I did like the science, and Ed Beach said, this is in part what Civ 5 players used to pull out of the demographic screen.
We're going to have a moon base.
But what I liked about the science was it told you about technologies researched, but it also told you about the science per turn.
That's much better. I'm a big fan of that.
So basically, they put Info Addict into the game.
I really like
it with all the mods. The screen in Civ 5 is a bit lackluster, isn't it? So a lot of those numbers tend to be fairly meaningless, especially population.
Great Generals give a movement bonus aside from the combat bonus, which means having more than one Great General is actually worth it now. Like in Civ 5, when I'm doing war, I generate a bunch of Great Generals, and I'm like, I don't really know. But now I can actually put them on the supply line so that they can give the extra movement to help reinforce my other units faster. So I'm really happy about the Great Generals having that. They have a radius of either 2 or 3 effectiveness as far as the combat and movement bonuses, so quite good. Also, Zone of Control is still back, of course, but not for all units. Chariots / Knights / Tanks, and I guess GDR, if that's in the game, I don't know.
Robots.
Unit I never see, because the game's over before that.
Yep. But they will also ignore Zone of Control, which makes them even faster than in Civ 5, which makes it better for setting up flanks. Or unit sniping, which I also use them for, so yay. Also different is that puppeting doesn't seem to be around, at least it was not in that particular video. Like, the only options you had were to keep the city, burn the city, and liberate the city to give it back to someone if it came from someone else.
Yeah, which ties into what we were talking about on the last episode about the different types of Cash's Belly.
Yeah, no, I wonder if there is a civic or tech that lets you puppet later? Question mark? I don't know. I would be surprised if puppeting is just straight up out of the game, but maybe you can't do it at the start.
Well, it could be gone.
In this case, we know that at the beginning, at least, you can't puppet. War weariness is back, and it affects housing and growth. From how they were explaining it as well, it seemed like if you own a city that you capture,
yes,
the city will always, like, permanently have some sort of a war weariness penalty, as in, so maybe this is their way of dealing with puppets, now that I think of it. If you capture a city, it can only grow to a certain potential because it has war weariness, and that limits its growth.
My understanding was that if you capture a city that belonged to someone else, and you continue to engage in war, and whether that's with the war of the city's founder or it's just war in general, they're going to suffer war weariness first. So it is possible, for whatever reason, maybe the type of war that you declared, you know, where warmonger penalties were halved, that perhaps war weariness doesn't kick in right away, but those captured cities, yeah, they're going to suffer war weariness first, and if they're suffering it first, then they're probably going to suffer it more severely as well, if it continues over time. So yes, the notion that Ed talked about is, quote, if you're a big warmonger, cities that might revolt out from under you, so yes, oh, it's to the point of the war weariness that, yes, they can revolt from under you, whether that means yep. they completely
especially
break
especially if you go bankrupt.
Yeah, there's also the bankruptcy, which I thought there wasn't realism in this game, darn it. No.
that you those, can't get rid of war weariness.
Well, I don't know if it completely stops when, say, a war ends with a particular civ, or all of your wars end with a particular civ, but I guess then the question becomes, while the war weariness effects are going on, is there a way that you can combat either that directly or incidentally, which I kind of took to be the amenities portions that they were talking about.
Yeah, I kind of had that same debate with you. Like, it may be permanent. There may be a way to stop the growth, like maybe a courthouse or something. Who knows?
But what if you starve a conquered city to size one and build a settler? Is it gone? And the war readiness is gone as well?
Well, you lose all the buildings and growth out of it.
I kind of like another question embedded in your question, Ruben, which is, if you take a city from someone else, and then you construct a settler in that city. You then found that city. Are those people yours? Or do they consider themselves descendants, you know, like quote-unquote forced immigrants into your civ because they were captured? So when you found that city, are they in fact native population?
That would be cruel.
maybe it's a matter of measure over time. Like, if you capture a city, and I think about in Civilization 4, right? Like, if you capture a city and you get that percentage breakdown, what's you and what's somebody else? And, of course, when you first capture that city, it's unlikely, but it's possible you might have a little bit of percentages that are yours in there. But then over time, that percentage shifts. Then maybe Civ 6 does something like that. I didn't see anything in the video where they were showing percentages and specific breakdown, like how much of it is non-native. But they did seem to imply that they are the first people that are going to get upset with your government, and they suffer war weariness first if they're non-native cities. So do they always stay non-native, or as time goes on, does the portion become less? Is it just a switch? We don't know.
The other part of it was that in the same minute, they were also saying, like, you're never really going to get war weariness in your capital. So I also think it may be part of proximity. Like, if you have a very, very far border town and you're at war, you might get some war weariness even if, like, it's not anywhere near the battleground. It might be some sort of way to stop wrecks.
Oh, okay. So if there's no war weariness ever in your capital, the one thing that I can think of your capital would differ from your other cities, other than the fact that it's probably the first city that you founded unless you lost your original capital, is that your capital would have the palace. So then is it the palace that's preventing the war weariness?
Maybe.
I guess it doesn't really matter. I'm just trying to think about how is that executed in the game. How do they prevent that city specifically? What would they code in there to prevent that from happening? Why did my mind go there immediately? I don't code games. My gosh. What has playing this game done to my brain? Absolutely. Only good things, I'm sure. Related to the city growth portion that Ed specifically talked about, we have a new rule for Civ. You know how we had, like, Sorin's identification of the third old, the third changed, and a third removed? Now we've got a 1-2-3 rule for city growth, which also tied into what we were saying before about how are amenities and housing working here, like what's going on, and also luxury resources, how does that tie in? Because we don't have global happiness anymore, it's local happiness. In this live stream, Ed tried to connect these dots together, which was wonderful. One, quote, one-to-one relationship between what your population can be and how much your housing is, unquote. It's not a hard cap, so you've got a housing capacity of 3, then when you're within 1 of that housing cap, your growth starts to slow, and then it gets really slow above that cap. It is possible to still grow, but it's probably exponentially a number of turns that maybe exceed how much longer you think the game is going to be, or you're not going to be able to really realize it, practically speaking. You want more housing to continue that growth, which to me is just kind of the next version of, oh, this happiness hit in Civilization 5. You're at 2 unhappy. Your growth is going to be slower at 4 unhappy than it is going to be at 2 unhappy.
Yeah. It's weird.
Sounds like you can't grow megacities anymore. Like, oh, 50 or something.
Well,
seems that you can get a lot of growth. I was looking at that little tab of how you can get more growth, and entertainment was a big thing for growth.
Oh, yeah, the entertainment complex, yeah.
Yeah, I think you put, like, a entertainment complex in your capital, and it would grow pretty good.
It makes sense that with housing gives you the capacity to fill people into your cities and get your city to grow. But then once people are there, you want them to at least be content. You know, to use kind of the equivalent of some previous Civ games. Not necessarily happy, but they're content. You don't want them to be unhappy. And when it comes to having that capacity for that initial housing, you've got city founding, like is there fresh water? How much land do you have, or quote-unquote grabbed and improved around the city? So Ed talks about farmland. So we're going from the very beginning of the game to the early to the mid-game. And then Ed specifically talks about in the later game, quote, replacing farmlands with suburbs, which are known in Civ as neighborhoods. That neighborhoods become a specific district on the map, just like an entertainment district would, then additional housing goes into those, which I guess maybe it means that you can get the really large cities, however we want to define that. Is a size 2 city in Civ 6 analogous, however we describe that, to a size 2 city in Civ 5? And that if you want to get to those larger cities, you're going to have to get to the point where you can, in fact, construct neighborhoods and then actually go ahead and make that neighborhood district.
Luxury resources, they'll factor into your expansion plan. When you have a luxury, gives you plus one, I'm trying to say growth, but I don't think that's the right word. Would you say
amenity. Remember in Civilization V, it was initially you had a luxury resource connected and they gave you 5 happiness and people went, whoa, that's too much, and they scaled it down to 4. Yeah, they kept the 4 rule, but of course, it's not a global happiness pool. Those 4 amenities, up to 4 cities, 4 cities can benefit. How are they automatically spread? Or do they automatically spread? And the answer is yes. They've coded in what they call a luxury resources governor to decide where to put these amenities based on luxuries and other things to make people the most happy. What's not clear is if you wanted to micromanage it, can you? I took away from it.
I was just about to ask that.
Yeah, I got the impression you can't, even if you wanted
to. You can't.
No, yeah. I wish you could micro, but they straight up said you can't micro it. It seems to be they're going to divvy it up to the cities that they believe want to grow to the next pop, but it's weird. It's also possible that it's proximity. It's also possible it's just balancing them. There's not one that has a lopsided amount of amenities and the other one doesn't. They didn't exactly say what they were going to do with spreading them out. They said spread them out. I don't know how that you do that.
I thought they went to the lowest one. I thought it was like they try to make sure that the lowest ones are covered and then they kind of bring up the rear. That's what
maybe?
I understood. Yeah, so that like you don't get rebellions on your hands or whatever, but everything can grow.
Well, yeah, that's probably part of it. They'll make sure that you at least are not losing food.
I mean, if every city is going to have an amenity, and let's say on, you know, our home continent, and I know using the word continent instead of six is a loaded term, but let's just, if I'm on my home continent and I've just hooked up coffee, sorry, Mackie, that one source of coffee doesn't give any more than, say, one source.
You have to share it.
Yeah.
You have to share it, Mackie.
Then the question becomes, if there's a city on another continent, is it going to be able to benefit just as much or more from that coffee? Like, yeah, like that distribution, how does it decide what the 4 cities are? I'm assuming it's some kind of local consideration. And I'm kind of going to what they said here. Ed specifically talked about that cities can be really dominated by their local concerns. There are regional effects within 6 tiles. That wasn't said in any specific context. I don't know exactly how it's going to be, but to me it would seem like if you've got a coffee resource on this particular hex, whatever the nearest 4 cities are, they're the ones that can benefit from it. But whether that means that's one amenity for each city, or they try to put more amenities in a larger city because they're kind of really starving for amenities and there's concerns about there being some kind of revolt, I don't know. I would actually like to think that if it had a choice, it could go up to 4, but on balance, if I put 2 in this largest of the 4 cities, then that's going to prevent it from being some kind of revolt, that the luxury resources governor would recognize that and do that for me, especially since I can't override it.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's really controlling the damage, the best way to do it in this, because if it's not doing that, you could really get screwed over and have no control on top of that. I don't think that feels real good as, like, the player.
But, man, I really want a day one mod that allows me to micromanage the luxury resources governor if I want to. I like that it's done by default, absolutely, especially when we're just learning the game or new players in general or players that really don't want to go, you know, quote-unquote knee-deep, because I'm pretty sure most people on this panel, I'm sure all of us on this panel, and most people listening to this probably wouldn't describe themselves as casual Civ players. And at some point, even if we don't want to keep doing it, hey, I'm going to try my hand at managing it. oh, it's way too much of a micromanagement nightmare, or I can do it, but it's six half dozen of the other, there's enough stuff to do on my turn, especially if I'm in multiplayer and people are like, end your turn already. But with that, districts, and it jumps ahead to the three here in the 1, 2, 3. Three is just population is critical in this game, because for every three population, you get to support a district. So when you're thinking about, I want to be able to place this district down, oh, my population isn't high enough. How do I get my population high enough? Oh, I'm hitting a growth cap. Oh, sounds like I need more housing. How does that work? Oh, it's a one-to-one relationship. Okay. Uh-oh, I'm trying to grow, but people are starting to grumble. There's an amenity issue. You need one amenity for every two citizens, but the first two are free. So it means starting at three, you need an amenity. In order to keep people happy, if I'm at three, I need an amenity. And then if I want to go to five, I need another amenity, which could include getting it from a luxury resource in that city, because, again, a luxury resource is going to give four amenities to be spread somehow.
Yep.
And the other thing that they pointed out, and I'm glad they pointed this out, because I think if we started to play the game, we might say, is this a bug already? Because it is the luxury resources governor code that's doing it automatically, and it's doing it on your turn rollover. If you hook up Coffee this turn, or Trajan, buddy-buddy with him, he is now sending you a coffee resource, you are not going to realize the benefit of that until the next turn. To which Anton described as, it's like the real-world equivalent of quote-unquote red tape to get the luxury into the system and to be distributed within the network. And I'm like, really,
that's how
Anton?
You explain it. Yep, that's how you explain it.
Yep. I, you know what, Anton? That is a great realism explanation of why it takes the turn rollover.
Oh, my. You're going to make all those people who love realism happy.
It takes 20 years to do this.
Oh, yeah. Early on, man, that's going to... That might 400. Take, like, yeah, like take decades for it to happen. Yeah, exactly. I don't think we'll talk about specifically how the combat outcome was in the game with Ed controlling as Rome, although he did point out that his nearest neighbor to the east was Japan, and Japan's hidden agenda was liking cultured civs, and Rome starts off with a monument in each city. Yeah. Oh, I just started this game earlier this week, Ed says. Yeah, like you didn't set that up on purpose. I believe you.
Time for friendship.
Because friendship is magic. Yes, I went there. The city details screen, in terms of what you can get amenities from, that was the other nice thing about the screen. Like, where do we get amenities from? In addition to all the blah, 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 blah. Out of grants, amenities from luxury resources, civics, entertainment, great people, religion, national parks, war awareness, and my favorite, amenities from bankruptcy.
Ooh. What?
So, don't get bankrupt.
Well, if you declare bankruptcy, then your creditors are screwed. So yeah. That's why you're happy? Is that that's supposed to mean? Why did I get amenities from bankruptcy?
Yeah, that's how it works, Dan. You get plus growth from bankruptcy.
Woohoo! No more debts! But your credit score is screwed, though. No more debts! No one's going to want to trade with you. You don't pay your bill. No more debt. Oh, yeah, okay.
If you're just giving out bonds.
It would be great if the citizens who you lose from the bankruptcy or war weariness go to your neighboring civs, because lols. That's not going to happen, though.
How to make the player angry, 101.
And further to confirm, we kind of alluded to very early on, and Ed specifically says, so in the chat, someone wants to know, can Congo win a religious victory, given what we've talked about, and we talked about Congo on the last episode, where they can't found a religion? The answer, no.
But Arabia is a counterweight to that, so it's fine. Sort of.
Yes. Comments on YouTube. I actually went through the 700-plus comments to try to find something interesting. And I know it's like finding a diamond in the rough on the internet, but I found diamonds. Crimson Vagus asks, one way to fix this is to make the Congo able to steal the founder bonus of the first civ they completely eliminate and then gain the benefits of the religion victory after that as long as they control the holy city. This may be overpowered, but also requires a lot of variables to trigger the effect so it kind of evens out. Question mark? Maybe? Question mark?
I think Congo has plenty of ways to win without having to have a religious victory. I mean, it sucks that they don't have a victory, but they are very, very focused toward other victories that we, you know, it's not like they're that damaged by it. Yeah, frankly, it means that they don't have to have the opportunity cost to build a bunch of faith.
Yes, exactly. And so they can go and they can, fine, you can sit back there constructing your religious buildings and spreading your religion. I'm going to build units. And I'm going to wipe you out. And then I will win. And then you will, not only will you not win religious victory, but you won't win anything because I've wiped you from the game. You're gone.
You'll win as a peace screen.
But it's just like it was also came up in the chat. It's like, you want to win a culture victory, you got to have the most of this, that, and the other thing. Well, why don't I just eliminate everyone else from the map? And as I take their cities, I just increase my culture and tourism output, so their culture and tourism is mine. But man, wouldn't that be really trolly? It's like, oh, I'm sorry, this is actually culture and tourism generated by the civ you conquered. You can't actually make use of that because there's some kind of weariness of you being able to use that culture, so it doesn't apply to you. Why am I giving them ideas? I blame you, Drew. I blame you, Drew.
I know. I know. I did it. It was me. System requirements.
If your system at least capable of running Windows 7, then you're probably fine.
It's definitely
more or less.
I can't really grasp how much higher it is.
The minimum list is they want you to have Windows 7 64. Well, they want you to have 64-bit system regardless.
That's a given.
7, 8.1, or 10. The minimum memory is 4 gig of RAM, but the recommended is 8. And video cards recommended is 1 gig of DirectX 11, and the recommended is 2 gig DirectX 11. So the recommended and minimum aren't too different except for the big chunk of memory. I mean, they do want better processor. Yeah, so
64-bit on. Do it, finally.
Yeah.
Imagine not doing it, I'll say it.
I don't know what, like, the average person has, so it's hard for me to tell.
Yeah, I know. I was looking at the processor, and I can't really tell how much more powerful the minimum versus the recommended. I'm going, huh?
Yeah, I'm not sure either.
Well, my take on the system requirements being revealed was actually quite disappointing, because I don't have a valid reason to purchase a new computer right now. I will find an invalid reason. Go, go, go. There will be some people that will go gur and arg about under the other requirements heading.
Steam authentication.
The initial installation requires one-time internet connection for Steam authentication. What is that? I can't believe I'm blanking on it. What is that term for a computer that has never been connected to the net? There's a term for that.
Worthless?
Kind of right.
Air gap. There it is. Ah, I found it. All right. An air gap. So I guess that means I can't play Civilization VI on my air gap computer? Are you kidding? That's terrible. Why do they hate air gap computers? Y2K, Y4Axis, why? Why do you hate them?
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. They said, you know, it's not going to be much more demanding than 5, but quadrupling the video requirement.
Well, now I just have to worry about my system requirements. Can I handle?
Pay for the shiny.
I just hope it works a lot better than Civilization V because my system uses up a lot of resources just looking at the menu screen. I find that pretty odd.
Yeah, but if everybody are getting SSDs, that might not matter.
Well, I do have SSDs, but it's still an issue, and I don't understand it. I fear bad coding or something, but I'm not a coder, so I shouldn't talk. Shut up.
And there's also the questions of, can we see the game settings menu? Like, are there options for, like, graphics settings?
Yeah, the resolutions, what can we turn on and off? Is there something equivalent to the, strategic map setting in 5?
Well, I know initially when Civ 5 came out, some people, that was the only way, at a certain point in the game, they could actually play the game, because it would just chug along, especially in the later turns, and the turn time was rolling over. There was just so many things on the screen. But when Mackie, you were talking specifically about, like, what can I turn off? This is an old Civ talking. Sounds kind of strange, but anyway, an old Civ player talking makes me think about turning off the animated herald in Civilization 2 was a sign that your computer configuration was weak.
Wow.
And it still is. I never had to turn off the animated herald, by the
way.
But
everybody turned off combat animations after a while, especially if you're playing multiplayer, because, oh God, it takes so long. And you have a turn timer sometimes.
Actually, that reminds me from the live stream. There was no quick combat, quick movement shown on the screen, so...
There is there? Quick combat, but it doesn't just skip the animation. It just plays really, really fast. I really like it.
Oh, good. Oh, okay.
Oh, it's like getting to fast forward.
Yeah, it's like
speedy combat instead of just instant movement.
Looks like it's about 4 times the speed from what I saw, so...
Okay. So based on that, Firaxis, for their next live stream, they're going to turn on quick combat and quick animation, and we can see 4 times as many turns. Yes!
Mm-hmm. Whoosh, whoosh, whoosh.
That's what I was going for with 4X. There you go.
Oh, well, yeah. What else does this game have to do with 4X, Drew? I mean, really.
Well, Watch Mojo talks a little bit about top video games of our history, and what they say specifically is time to check out the games that change history, but not in the way you think. These are the games that made up their own series of crazy events, created their own timeline, and rewrote the history books to better suit their admittedly awesome needs. And they promptly go to show us Washington being upset at being number 10 in the list. Fortunately, ending up at the bottom.
Yeah. So it was 10 on the top 10 list.
I thought that was kind of funny, but it did make sense in a way that I don't even know how you could put these in a list together just because it's rewrote a different way every time, so it's kind of hard to compare the two, but I see what they were going for.
What better place to start than with a game that literally makes your own history from the ground up? Starting as a small cluster of life, players have to chart a course if their growing populace is to flourish into an actual superpower. Depending on which route they choose to take to achieve this, whether it be through focusing on diplomacy, economics, technology, or conquest, the outcome will vary into something far removed from historically correct. The amount of content will ensure that no one playthrough will ever be the same, and the civilization you eventually create will either be built on great achievements or the bones of your enemies.
I have a bone to pick. How come it can't be great achievements and your enemies, so I don't have to choose, do I?
I thought they were the same thing.
Oh, okay. Whew. I also like the description. Starting as a small cluster of life. We all started as a small cluster of life when you think about it. Not just civilization.
I think it's
hard. I like how Mackie went to the Big Bang of the start of the life, so to speak. But anyway, yes.
True, we were all small cluster of hydrogen atoms at one point, yes.
And I also like, after they finished doing the voiceover for Civ, cue Baba Yetu. That was the correct choice.
Yeah, it sounds a little bit less upset of being number 10 in that list. But yeah, all the other ones, you know, they were quite interesting stories, and mostly revolving around the Cold War or World War II happening a little bit differently. I do like the Command & Conquerors up there, because I did really like their side story of how things could have played out differently.
Command & Conquerors, though, are the top two. It's hilarious.
Yeah, Wolfenstein is number 2. I was like, what? I haven't played a lot of these other titles, so I don't actually know how I would rate them, to be honest. Like, all these shooters, I haven't played.
Fallout is also an interesting series of what they do with this kind of stuff.
Fallout, I feel like, is one of the most interesting ones definitely out there.
Support the ongoing Polycast Patreon campaign.
Collective achievements.
Personal incentives.
Month-to-month commitment.
For more information, visit thepolycast.net/Patreon.
Call in today.
In North America, 301-637-7659.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
Log on to the series' official website at
thepolycast.net.
On the Watch Mojo channel.
Pointless of my opinion, of course. It's the top 10 of most anticipated stuff releasing in October. And on third place is Civilization 6. So, another hype video or a marketing ploy, I don't know. I'm not the hype type of person. Mostly when I watch those anticipation videos, top tens, they usually tell me what to steer away from. So,
you know, there's this title that the company has paid us a bunch of money to tell you it's the most anticipated thing this month.
Yeah, and it tells me, don't bother about that.
Or wait for the reviews at the very least.
So, Ruben's retiring from Civ?
Yeah.
on that list.
I wonder who the first jerk in our Turncast group, possibly me, will try to sneak in a religious victory. It might be me.
You have the stocking, right?
It could be everybody.
Wait, Drew, do you really want to be put on notice already? The game isn't even out yet. Why are you telegraphing these things?
I may also be the jerk who cites a holy war CB if Condorism is founded.
I will fight.
Your noble cause, the purge of the heathen, don't worry.
I will fight the good fight to ensure Condorism is spread far and wide. Thank you very much.
Oh, dear.
Befriend one or two Civs that follow your faith and then tell everybody else and win a religious victory. That might be the most typical outcome, actually, if going for that
yeah.
one. So that's picturing. Because it's going to be pretty tough if people run Inquisitors or this your religion at all to get a dominant religion everywhere. Unless you just kill everyone who resists. Which was probably good.
And then it can truly be, when I said I'd kill you last, I actually, no, I told the truth.
This has been episode 266 of Polycast, here with my usual co-host, Dan Q.
Waiting for the shiny.
And the Mian team.
I am the best at bypassing your zone of control.
I believe that, actually. And our guest co-host, ZT Zarish.
How you doing?
Dre Zane.
1, 2, 3, 4, I declare a holy war.
Especially if it's against a commanderism. And Ruben.
Yeah, and I'm a living contradiction. My brain's made loose.
You know, a couple days ago, like, I thought I was not going to be able to make it. I got sick again. I rarely get sick. The other time I got sick was when you brought me to Polycast the first time. So what I'm going for is that I think that Dan is the reason I get sick. Because the only time I get sick is when I'm invited to the Polycast. But I did make it. Correlation and causality.
I was going to say,
exactly.
It's psychological. When you stress out and you get sick, as like a side effect?
No, I think it's seasonal, but I think it's still funny. Oh, we're not live yet, are we?
No, we're not live, no.
It's not third cast.
Well, it is recorded, don't worry, Drew. It's already recorded, it's okay, it doesn't matter.
I'm Polycast cut.
If I go on and off mute, that is because I'm trying not to cough in everybody's face. Virtually.
Yeah, even I've got a bit of a sore throat this morning now. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and...
Here.
Well, he's on the call, but he just stepped away momentarily.
Okay. I mean, I'll say his name and leave it to think, I guess.
Yeah, it might get falsetto Drew. Falsetto Drew. Yeah.
Wait, falsetto Drew? That's kind of weird.
Okay, I'm back.
I mean, yeah.
You defeated Dan. He was going to do falsetto Drew.
I guess I missed the good part.
I guess I'm just going to ask each of you to say in turn your username for post-production purposes. I will start with you, Drew.
I forgot.
Did you forget your username?
I forgot my name.
And I kind of feel like often when people cite it, hey, I don't have the strategic resource in order to construct my unique unit. How many times was Rome cited for that as compared to any other civ?
Where's my iron?
And then you're going to settle a bunch of cities and discover you have no iron later and no realistic way to acquire it.
Yeah, either that or, hey, I see iron on the map, but I'm already past the era by which time I would be using this unit. So
that's really annoying.
Restart!
I'm glad I was able to be instrumental to your discussion, Dan.
Translation from Drew. I'm glad I could be your placeholder. Well, Drew, you can be my placeholder anytime. What? I don't know. Man, if you're on a war cart as Samaria, and you start on flat land, and you got, like, 4 movement, wow. Hey.
Yeah, man. Zoom, zoom, zoom.
Unless
fine.
You're Congo, it would be religion minus.
Oh. Religion minus all the headaches of heresy.
Well, it's quite...
Okay,
unique.
I'm definitely going to declare holy war.
Like you weren't before. How dare you make it like this?
Yeah, but now I have a CB.
Like you didn't have a CB before.
It's true.
CB, yeah. He's Dan Quick.
If they don't want to play, they don't have to play. There's so many people who are going to be like, I don't understand, but I'll just play Civ 5 and fine. Or play Civ 4, that's fine. You don't have to play anything. You don't have
true.
To even play Civ.
Oh, well. That's
well, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say but such heresy.
Alright, so Ruben's new theme is instead of Constant Craving by Katie Lang, it's just Contradiction. Now you've got that in your head. Enjoy.
I'm just not biting onto the hype.
Says
of course,
someone,
shows,
I was about to say, says the guest panelist on the show where we're talking about Civ 6 is coming out. Oh, you got to admit you walked into that one. You got to admit you walked into that one, Ruben.
I think you're putting words in my mouth. I think that you're projecting your hatred of Civ 6 on me.
Wait, what?
That joke would have been humorous if you said, I think you're just projecting your hate of your own show onto me. And then I would have been like, oh, hell no. But,
man.
So, yeah, I know.
I almost got it right.
Almost got it right, said every man in history.
La, 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 la.
Max not disagreeing. La, la, la.
All of you shut up.
Wait. All of us shut up. I think Mackie has just done the closing.
No, that was the Facebook feed.
Shut it up.
But,
shut it up, you.
Record date October 1st, 2016. Watch Mojo Clips copyright Watch Mojo. Civilization 4, 5, and Beyond Earth sound clips copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.